Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a noted sociologist who has long examined racial and ethnic inequality, especially how it relates to urban areas, poverty, and place. Bruce D. Haynes' scholarly work is focused on the effects of race in suburban communities, race in new urbanism, and the issues within urban areas' most impoverished neighborhoods. But his latest book is part memoir and part social history of his family and their neighborhood. Haynes is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Davis, but he grew up in Harlem as a third-generation black professional in Sugar Hill. His grandfather was George Haynes, founder of the Urban League, and a noted college educator. W.E.B. Du Bois was his mentor. His grandmother was Harlem Renaissance writer Elizabeth Ross Haynes. Their stylish brownstone was the home of many gatherings of black elites in the first half of the 20th century. Later, his father and mother, Edmund and Daisy, second-generation college-educated professionals, lived in the house. Yet the tenuous nature of success in the black middle class becomes evident as social forces rock their neighborhood, family, and home. Haynes's oldest brother radicalizes during the tenth civil rights era of the late 1960s. Later, he embraces the Nation of Islam, then turns to drugs. Haynes's other brother is killed in a random unsolved murder. Only the author graduates college. His book, Down the Up Staircase, written with his wife, Sima Solovich, captures the forces that influenced his family and community, the Great Migration, Harlem Renaissance, the Civil Rights Era, the Black Power and Black Arts Movement, but also the negative social forces that changed Harlem during the 60s and 70s. Haynes is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Bruce Haynes, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Rick, for having me on.
Your academic work and professional work and research is focused on racial and ethnic inequality and, interestingly, how places and spaces or communities either contribute to or are influenced by inequality. And so I think when I was reading Down the Up Staircase, it's a memoir of your family, it sort of brings all this professional work down to a micro level. Was that an intent?
Oh, most definitely. In fact, the intent, you might say, is to bring the skills of my discipline of sociology to bear on my life, and to bring, the structural and organizational component of explanation that sociology provides, and to root that in a organic, true story.
I imagine that was kind of difficult. I mean, it's far easier looking at others' lives than looking at your own and your own family.
Well, maybe that's why I needed a co-author. I'm not sure I could have written this without my co-author. My co-author is my spouse, Sima Solovich, and, you know, she knew my folks and my brother and was able to push me to say things that I might not have been willing to say otherwise, to reveal parts of myself, for instance, that I probably would have been more guarded.
That was a difficult part of the writing, is to talk about yourself in the same way you would look at a subject you're writing research about or something.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's not myself so much I was worried about exposing, but my family. You know, growing up in a black middle-class family in Harlem, you know, this notion of a politics of respectability that, you know, I should carry myself in a particular way, and, you know, so those dirty, dark secrets of the family don't get revealed. And so to talk about sort of the dark side of family life, whether it be drug use or psychiatric challenges or family dysfunction, you know, these are not things that I talked about easily.
And that was, I think, a key theme in this book, is the idea of how important was it, certainly to your parents, that they project an image, certainly your mother especially, that she is projecting this incredibly successful image. Clothes is a big part of it, but also just everything she's involved with in the community, you know, hiding what was some serious dysfunctions within your own family.
Well, you know, it's funny. On the one hand, it's hiding. On the other hand, it was the costume that one needed to wear if one wanted any sense of self-respect out in public. And so, you know, the wearing of fancy clothes and dressing up was necessary if you wanted to be treated seriously when you went shopping downtown, for example. So there was there are two sides to that, I guess. So some of it was about, you know, maintaining this front stage of respectability, but also it was also about being able to wield the status that you rightfully had achieved. as a middle-class person.
Yeah, and that's important to remember during the time you're writing about. She had to be dressed to the nines to be able even to walk in some of those establishments, even though they were officially desegregated.
Desegregated, but probably 90% of the black people at, say, a Saks Fifth Avenue were behind the counters, not in front of the counters.
Right.
And so, it was quite easy for a black person to walk into a high-end department store and a salesperson say, oh, no, you don't want to look at this. You want to look at the sales bin over here because there's this assumption that you couldn't possibly afford what you're looking at. And so in order to counteract that, you know, mom comes in with, you know, a mink coat and, you know, rings and nails done and no doubt that there's a little cash there.
Yeah.
So this is part of, I think, what other scholars have called the politics of respectability and was very much a part of my upbringing.
Your family home in Harlem, Hamilton Heights or Sugar Hill, it plays a big role in this story because in many ways it's a metaphor of your family's life as well as the community. Was that conscious on your part?
Well, it was, and, you know, I wanted to capture the story about my grandfather, which might be one of the reasons why I wrote this. I mean, I wanted to capture the story of this guy from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, who migrates to New York City and manages to not only graduate Fisk and become a mentee of Du Bois, but also become the first African-American to get a Ph.D. at Columbia University and to go on and found the National Urban League. And it was because of George Haynes and his wife, Elizabeth, coming to the city and buying this home in Sugar Hill that I was able to actually grow up in this home that was handed down to us.
He was a pretty amazing man that really you didn't know much about growing up, did you?
You know, I lived, you might say, in a shadow. I knew he was an educator. I knew he had founded the National Urban League. But I didn't know he had studied sociology. I didn't really know much of the details. I really didn't know anything about his wife, Elizabeth, because she was certainly his equal in accomplishments, having written the first children's book for African-American children back in 1920s and published by Du Bois. And that was written when my father was about 9 years old. So, you know, she was overshadowed by George Haynes, and George Haynes was sort of overshadowed by the Du Boises and E. Franklin Frasers of sociology. So no one seems to remember George Haynes and the great things that he did.
You know, you talk about the shadow, and really your father seemed to grow up in the shadow of his father, George Haynes. He was George Jr., but went by Edmund. And in many ways, it seems like that was the case.
He did, and I imagine, you know, he grew up in this very high-powered academic couple, which was very unique for a black child in 1915. And he was probably lonely a lot of the times because I imagine that the demanding hours that were required for the kinds of careers that they pursued, and he was an only child. That meant that he was probably by himself a lot. And I have to admit, you know, he compensated for that later when he became a father because he was very much the doting father who took all of us boys to the zoo and to the park and to the beach. And I think the kinds of things that he maybe missed, wished he had more of from his own father. Living in that legacy was a challenge for him as well, I think.
Yeah, he was also college educated, as was your mother. This family really had this huge devotion to education in everything they did. But
almost definitely, well, they got there. They met in graduate school in 1948 at Atlanta University while they were both getting their masters of social work. And my father went on to become a parole officer, and my mother went on to become a social worker, and then a kind of program analyst for the State Department of Mental Hygiene, a kind of expert on state programs and hospital programs. And they're very educated and very much for the three boys growing up. We all went to private schools, and my parents did this on social worker salaries living in Manhattan, which was not an easy feat. And so there was a lot of borrowing from the future to pay off the debt. And in fact, my father worked right up until I graduated college. The year I graduated college in 1982, my father was pushing 80, and that's when he retired.
Yeah, so he always worked to make sure that you guys had that same education that he did and that his father had had. But you tell the story of this house, which I guess in its heyday during the Harlem Renaissance was almost like a salon in many cases. In fact,
well, they were very much involved in the Harlem Renaissance, and that was one of the pieces I think I was most surprised. I mean, everything from holding poetry readings of people like Langston Hughes and classical music at the YMCA on 135th Street to becoming involved with the Harmon Foundation. George Haynes gave out the awards for the Harmon Foundation, which were the way in which the Urban League's Opportunity magazine signified who were the movers and shakers of the Harlem Renaissance. And so he was very much a part of the generation that determined who were going to be the who's who of that generation.
And so that house had this brilliant history, but something happened during the course of your parents' marriage in which your father basically just decided to let the house go. Or maybe it was a matter of money was going for education, money was going, your mother was, well, she liked to spend money.
And I think you nailed it, and I was looking for that complicated balance, because it wasn't just one thing. It was, yes, my father had this backward economics thinking, well, if we don't fix the roof, then we're saving money, so we'll just keep patching an approach to things. But there was also the reality that, hey, we're making $30,000 on social worker salaries, and we're living in Manhattan, raising three kids and trying to send them to the best schools in the city. And so the real economic constraints and choices had to be made. And at the same time, there was, I think, the house took the toll of my parents' marriage as the marriage turned sour. And there was resentment, and mom stopped cleaning, and dad stopped fixing, and there was a kind of stalemate that kind of occurred that allowed the house to deteriorate. Well, at the same time, there really wasn't much money to go into the house if we were going to keep sending me to the best schools and wearing clothes from Saks.
In the book, you sort of write that perhaps there was a seminal moment when things started changing for your parents, and it was your mother's discovery that your father had briefly been married at least one other time, and actually it was two other times.
It's very interesting. I remember an incident when I was very young of major fight that my parents had before I was heading off to school, and I mean, it was an unusual kind of a fight, and Dad tossed a bottle of Zestab through the window. I distinctly remember, because a little bottle of Zestab used to sit there every morning, and we'd get our Zestab. And later, when I was about 11 years old, the nanny housekeeper, Miss Granberry, who was taking care of me back from when I was very young, she pulled me aside and told me that this event had happened, and that my father had been married before, and that it wasn't my fault, and I shouldn't take any blame, though I had no reason to believe why it would have anything to do with me. But you know, this is what she said. She didn't want me to internalize this stuff, but she wanted me to know for the future. And I must admit, 20 years later, I distinctly remembered this conversation, and when I went back to my father's papers after he passed away, I discovered, in fact, that he'd been married twice, not just once, during the war. And they were both war brides. Both marriages lasted for less than a year. And he left the lawyer's papers in his file. That's why I was able to actually know this was a fact and not just a rumor. So, yes, this was clearly the event that suddenly put a ripple in this otherwise very idyllic relationship that my parents had. You know, they had two children, and I was the third coming along, and I had been recently born, and now suddenly there is this big divide between them that probably remained right up until their final days together.
You write that your father, Edmund, was a very reserved man who did not let his emotions show very often. And you said when he threw that bottle of tablets through the window, he never fixed that window. That was probably one of the few times you ever saw him expressing his temper.
Well, you know, when he expressed his temper, it was sort of like it was, as you have to use the term, he was blowing his top would be the way. It was so unusual, and he would be so out of control. And it only happened maybe on one or two occasions. disturbed, and that was one of them. He was, I called him in the book a kind of Dick Tracy kind of character, because, you know, he wore a suit and tie and sport jacket and carried his .38 on his waistband under his coat, and he was a straight-laced guy who would never, steal a grape from a vendor. I mean, he'd feel guilty for taking anything that didn't belong to him. And so in terms of law enforcement, I got to say I've never met anyone who was probably a straight shooter as he was.
And, of course, he worked as a parole officer working in the South Bronx.
Back in the day when they believed that they could actually help the parolees before parole officers became...
Guy sitting at a desk, yeah. He was out working with them, right?
He was, and he was very proud of the fact. I remember him telling me that he had never, ever had to use his gun in some 30-some years of working in the Bronx.
My guest today is Bruce Haynes. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. He has co-authored the book, The Down the Up Staircase, with his wife, Sima Solovich. It's called Down the Up Staircase, Three Generations of a Harlem Family. It's published by Columbia University Press. I want to ask you about the preface of the book, because I understand it was very difficult for you to write, which tells the story of the house and your parents in about 1995. And by this time, the house is, your parents were doing Herculean work, actually living in the house, hauling water. The house was in complete disrepair. And you said it was very difficult to write. Why did you decide to open the book with this story?
Well, you know, there are certain aspects of the book that seem to be so natural. This event did occur, and Dad did come up to me on his final Thanksgiving to bring me a picture of his father that I then discovered was an oil painting done by the Harlem Renaissance artist Laura Wheeler Waring, and painted of my grandfather during the Harlem Renaissance under the auspices of the WPA. And so it was a fascinating story, and it was also the story about the change in my life, because that year was a tremendous year for me. I finished my dissertation, my PhD dissertation, in May. I got married in July. I moved to New Haven and started as assistant professor at Yale University in September. And in November, Dad brought me the picture, and in December, Dad had died. Hmm. And so my whole life was transformed in a single year in a way that's hard to capture, because everything in my world changed. My family changed, the structure of my family changed, my responsibilities changed, my life began, my career began, my marriage began. And it was all tied in some ways to this event of this last Thanksgiving I got to share with both my parents.
Of course, that house, again, as I say, it's such a metaphor for your family's life. By 1995, this house is in utter disrepair. And like the neighborhood itself, had utterly transformed. And it becomes a larger story of a community, that everything that was happening in your family with its tensions and dysfunctions, your brothers, George III, who, you know, goes through a period of black nationalism, period with the Nation of Islam.
I really wanted to capture the story about why growing up in this relatively prestigious family, you know, we were very successful. My parents had master's degrees. They had stable jobs. But why was it that out of three sons, only one managed to, you know, maintain the middle-class status? And I wanted to capture this reality for families like my own, but also as representative of other black families that some had remained in Harlem and some that were able to leave Harlem, but black families like my own who struggled to have mobility and to pass wealth across generations, and the ways in which race operated in such insidious ways through segregation and denial of the ability to transfer wealth and the denial of the ability to get good jobs. And had it not been for a number of mentors that I had, my life would have been much more like my brother's life.
You know, I was struck by something. Your father and your mother met in graduate school doing social work, and I was really struck by, this was one of the first fields where African Americans could actually become a professional. I mean, there were a few slots, say, in medicine or you know, as lawyers, but it was the first widespread where a black could become a professional, say, in the 1940s, 1930s, 1940s.
This is what makes my grandparents, in fact, so special, because George Haynes, who trained the first black social workers at Fisk University at the Social Science Department to be sent back up to Chicago for the Urban League in the late teens and early 20s, this was the beginning of black social work, and it was an extension of the Settlement House movement. And you might say he established the Settlement House movement for blacks because the Settlement House movement, as it existed, did not serve black migrants. So in forming the National Urban League, in fact, he coordinated with Du Bois a dual strategy where Du Bois was going to be more the agitator with his organization, the NAACP, and George Haynes was going to work in a progressive way with businesses on the employment side, to help the transition for black migrants and to help in that goal of Du Bois's in establishing that talented tent that he talked about in providing a leadership for the masses that were migrating to the north.
Certainly that was a big part of your family's life, even working in New York.
Yes, indeed. And I came to understand as I did my research that both of my parents were part of this tradition. They were the second generation of social workers. Both my parents pursued the field that my grandparents had started. And one of the things I began to realize as a sociologist, that sociology as a field was deeply wedded to the early days of social work. Because black social scientists, like my grandfather and Du Bois, were deeply concerned with the needs of black migrants. So, you know, sociology wasn't just an academic enterprise. It was getting knowledge so that one could address problems. And so the notion of social philanthropy and sociology were very much linked in those early days, whereas today we think of social work and sociology as very separate fields.
Mm. Earlier you alluded to the role of racial injustice in your family and many other middle-class black families that lived in Harlem. As the whole neighborhood changed in the 1960s and 1970s and all the neglect that came in and drugs that came into the community, as well as all of the other socioeconomic forces that were at play. How do you see the role of racial injustice in your own family story? I mean, certainly all three of the siblings, George III, Alan, and yourself, experienced, even in this private school upbringing, probably a lot of overt racism. You describe an incident with a teacher where he's doing a lecture on slavery and he has you standing up in front of the class like the only black kid in the class.
Indeed.
Almost like on the selling block of some sort. And I assume that occurred to all two of your siblings as well.
Well, you know, what's funny is that story, you know, stands out in my mind, and it only makes me wonder the kinds of stories that my brothers experienced. Because the world I grew up in the mid-1970s was very much more liberal than the world that my brothers were growing up in the late 60s. And so despite having these little incidents, I still was very well integrated into the schools, and I played on the sports teams and acted in the plays and got invited home and had girlfriends and felt very much that I was living the Martin Luther King life of the integrated black man when I was a teenager. Whereas my brothers, being the first generation of integration in the 60s, they experienced a lot more resistance, I think.
And of course, it took a toll. It was very poignant you writing about your brother Alan, who was obviously a huge emotional pillar for you growing up, because there was a big difference between ages and your siblings. And obviously, between your parents and you, it's almost like two generations probably between the parents and you. He died a pretty senseless death. He was working at a bicycle shop where he was working, and just nobody knows why he was killed to this day.
Yeah, my two brothers are very interesting. George took more to the radical side of things, and Alan, being 3 years younger, he had different experiences from George, so he ended up a little bit more integrated. He had hippie friends, and a lot of white friends and was well integrated, quote unquote, into rock and roll bands and pop culture in a way that George never was. And because of the age differences, I think I was always a little bit closer to Alan. You know, he's the one who got the stuck babysitting with me all the time, and so I think we got a little bit closer. And I modeled myself after him when I was a teenager. I wanted to dress like him, and I started smoking Sherman cigarettes because he smoked Sherman cigarettes, and I played the bass guitar because he played the bass guitar. And so, yes, in many, many ways, Alan was my role model, so to speak, growing up.
My guest today is Bruce Haynes, a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. He's a co-author with his wife, Sima Solovich, of Down the Up Staircase, Three Generations of a Harlem Family, about his family, but also about the neighborhood, the sociology, the family relations within his family. It's published by Columbia University Press. One of the things I read about the book was this book went through a lot of iterations as you were trying to figure out how to tell this story. People you were needed to be tougher on, people you need to relax on. How did your view of the people in the book, your family in the book, change, even your own view? Because you seem kind of tough on yourself. It's like, as far as you see yourself growing up, says, you know, I was sort of a mix between white culture and black culture, and I'm not sure exactly how I fit in. Or, you know, it seemed like to be that sort of course as you're writing the book. How did the...
You know, you could call that the theme of double consciousness. Maybe that's implicit in the book, this notion of the Negro fitting in into a society that really only partially sees the Negro, so to speak. And this notion of seeing oneself through the eyes of people who despise you, and this notion of double consciousness creates a conflict, as Du Bois described it. And I think... you know, that conflict takes place on many, many levels. It takes place at the level of pop culture in a way that black culture is both vilified and idealized. And so you might say that you're always walking a tightrope of being too black for one context but not being black enough for another context. And becoming a person who learned to code switch, I guess, as I moved between different environments and... and that's both in terms of race and class. I think the black middle class might be the quintessential chameleons to the degree that we learn. It's almost a necessary skill that we develop to navigate the segregated environments that we exist in.
Hmm. Now, the name of the book, it's a fascinating look at your family and the history of the neighborhood in which you grew up and social history as well as personal history. Down the Up Staircase. Professor Haynes, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thanks so much for having me on.
Bruce D. Haynes is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. He is co-author of Down the Up Staircase, Three Generations of a Harlem Family. It's published by Columbia University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.